Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event in association with Humanities West. We have a special treat for our audience tonight, our audience live here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And that is, we're going to discuss living in the material world, the future of the humanities. It's an ancient topic. It'll probably be an ancient topic 1,000 years from now. But it's a question that, of course, the people who love the humanities are always asking and how to deal with, and that is, in a world where physical survival and the effects of material life are the things that occupy most people, how do we present and how do we encourage and how do we educate our future leaders to have a broader perspective, to have access to the most interesting and sophisticated thoughts of our past, which we collect and keep. This is an interesting topic for me very much because I always find that not only in the humanities and in English, in literature and philosophy, but even in arts and architecture, you know, if there were 1,000 people who could paint like Michelangelo, do you think that we would keep Michelangelo's works? Probably not. And if there were 1,000 people who could do what Da Vinci did, would we keep the things that are, you know, falling apart and spend millions of dollars trying? No. And in architecture, would we keep the Colosseum looking like a ruin all this time? No, because we want, in my opinion, we want to see this. And it's quite interesting because there's a relatively small number of people who actually spend a lot of other people's money to make sure that all these great things last and stay. You know, and when the Parthenon was used by the Ottoman Turks as a place to store their military equipment and their ammunition and was blown up, well, you know, that's what they thought of it. And, of course, there were a few thousand or maybe a few hundred thousand people who didn't like that use of the Parthenon. But the vast majority of people are not willing to spend. I mean, in the original cost of the Parthenon was paid for by money that was collected by Athens to protect all the other city-states once they had made themselves the leader, and then they used the money to build the Parthenon to show that they were very powerful and also that they had these great ideas in architecture that would make things extraordinarily beautiful. But why do we keep all that stuff? We keep that, the small group of people that keep it, because we want to have an elevated, noble sense of humanity, I think. And we want to say, this is what we can accomplish. Why don't we do it on a daily basis? Of course, we don't. But we keep working towards that by educating one generation after another in the most sophisticated thoughts that are available, and then hope that they push it forward, hope that they push it forward, that there'll be more and more collected, and eventually this will have an ever greater influence on the way that we run things. Well, maybe it doesn't seem like that, but ideas are at the basis of everything that is done, all human institutions. And the American Constitution, the way that we do democracy, even if we're not that democratic about it anymore, or even if we never were that democratic about it, you know. But the idea is sitting there telling us what should work better, and if even use it, 10% of the idea, it works better. So I find that a fascinating thing, and it's great that we have UC Berkeley and Stanford both represented here as how they go about trying to do this with their wonderful top-notch students, and we have Ralph from Cal Humanities. So let me introduce the speakers for tonight to present this. We have Anthony Cascardi, the Dean of Arts and Humanities at the College of Letters and Science at UC Berkeley. Tony. We have Ralph Lewin, President and CEO of Cal Humanities on the end. We have Katie McDonough, Humanities and Arts Initiatives Coordinator, Office of the Dean, School of Humanities and Sciences at Stanford. And we have Tyler Stovall, Dean Undergraduate Division of the College of Letters and Science at UC Berkeley. So, what I'd like each of them to do is talk a little bit about how they're attacking this problem, this age-old problem, and it will be age-old forever, and in their own different ways. And each one will talk for 10 minutes or so, and then I'll let you have a chance to ask them all questions. So why don't we start with Tony?
Oh, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here and to talk about this topic with you. I will say some things toward the end of my remarks about how we are attacking the problem, as George puts it. But first, I want to think with you about the problem. And to do that, I want to invite you to come with me back to a moment in 1951. This is a moment, a particular moment, when the poet Wallace Stevens was asked by the Metropolitan Museum of New York to give a talk on the relations between poetry and painting. Now, the subject of the relations between poetry and painting is an age-old subject. You can read about it in Horace. You can read about it in Lessing. For the modernists, it was itself an issue. And, of course, the Metropolitan Museum wanted to know what the poet Wallace Stevens thought about the relations between poetry and painting. Here's a sample of what he had to say. I think you'll find that his response speaks very directly to the questions that we're talking about this evening. Poet and painter alike live and work in the midst of a generation that is experiencing essential poverty in the midst of fortune. The extension of the mind beyond the range of the mind, the projection of reality beyond reality, the determination to cover the ground, whatever it may be, not to be confined, the recapture of excitement and intensity of interest, the enlargement of the spirit at every time, in every way, these are the unities, the relations, to be summarized as paramount now. So Wallace Stevens was saying, forget about that very formulaic and no doubt worthwhile question of whether and how poetry and painting relate to one another. What's important is that they both relate insofar as they are part of the cause of what we call the humanities that serve the enlargement of the spirit and the extension of the mind. And to recognize this and to preserve this at a moment that is one that he characterizes as of poverty in spite of what he describes as fortune seems to me precisely a formulation of the question that's been posed here this evening. So what does it mean to think about the enlargement of the spirit and the extension of the mind, and why does it matter, and where do the humanities stand in relation to this, and what, if anything, can we do to preserve and encourage these things? Well, first I want to say that the humanities regarded in relation to what we're understanding the phrase material world to mean here is a difficult task. And the humanities are difficult because the task of being human is a difficult task. And by that I mean it asks us to respond in ways that are not automatic or literal or given to the worlds around us and to respond to the possibility that we might make and shape new ones. I was recently reading very interesting by the philosopher and psychoanalyst Jonathan Lear, who has a very nice way of formulating this, and it's by means of a comparison to a duck. So the task of being a duck for a duck is not something that's a problem, and it's not something that that's a challenge. A duck knows more or less instinctively what the duck needs to do in a very sort of immediate and task-oriented way. By the same token, to be a human biologically is not the answer. It's not a sufficient answer to what it means to realize the potential of being human. And that's a very difficult task. It's difficult because it's open-ended. It's difficult because there aren't clear answers to what it would mean to achieve the ends that are proper to a human being. It's difficult because we have the ability to respond to conditions that we imagine, conditions that are the conditions of the mind or the spirit in Wallace Stevens' terms, conditions that we make that are not the ones that present themselves to us. We have to imagine what a world might be like if we want to work to change a world. We have to imagine what might be, and we have to carry with us a legacy of the past in the way that a duck, although no doubt a very ancient creature with a genealogy, does not have to carry the past of duckness with it. And we have to make choices. And we have to make choices where ends and decisions are not always clear. Human beings are imaginative creatures, and we are historical creatures. We enter a world that we have made, even as the famous saying goes, if it has not been made in the ways we might have liked it. We're also value-seeking creatures, and by that I mean We seek to do things and to respond to things that realize value in ways that can't always be captured in some of the most prevalent ways of measuring or gauging these things. Many of those are quantitative ways. Many of the things that are of value can't be captured in those ways. And so as value-making and value-seeking beings, and as creatures who also reflect on the things that we do and that those who have come before us have done, we are given the option, and we are in fact faced with the task of establishing what values we want to seek. So this is all difficult enough and would be challenge enough for anyone. And yet I think we face a number of contemporary obstacles, and these are, I think, fairly specific obstacles that have made all this even the more difficult. And one of those is the obstacle that's been named in the program for this evening, and that's materialism. But I want to just for a minute tease out a bit of what materialism is standing for and some of the many things that I think it's naming or it might name. And one is a general short-sightedness. So to respond to what is most immediate, to respond to what might reap the most direct or immediate benefits or gains tempts us to a limitation of what our capacity as human beings might be that, in fact, undervalues and underestimates our potential. I think materialism is one manifestation of a kind of short-sightedness, and I think we could have a very interesting and long conversation about short-sightedness in many contexts, one of which would certainly be the contemporary academic context. A second element is political, and by the political here, I mean the fact that we are lacking a public space, and the Commonwealth Club is a great and wonderful exception to this, but we're lacking a public space and a public forum, and by that I mean a generally political forum for the discussion and the debate of ideas about value that really matter. And what we've seen, I think, systematically is a shriveling of the compass of the political to the strictly economic. So with a very few exceptions, and in those exceptional instances, our political debates tend to be extreme and extremely polarized. With those exceptions, largely our political debates are around matters of, you might say, materialism. The result is, I think, a very bad form of pragmatism, a form of pragmatism that plays into our need for the immediacy of response, that is a response to the conditions that exist, that does not succeed in helping us realize any human creative, imaginative, historical potential, and that the humanities in a very deep and persistent way are working against. This conversation, this set of issues, is an old one. It will be an ongoing one, but I want to say I don't regard that as disappointment or discouragement, because I think, in fact, the fundamental task of the humanities is to keep reminding us and opening us to the possibility that we are, in fact, creatures that go beyond our material conditions. That we are also material, biological, et cetera, creatures is a fact. And so we will naturally be tempted to approach our lives in those ways. But I think it's the ongoing task of the humanities to say there is something more. What do we need to do that? I think we need to work at all levels, and perhaps in the question and answer we can talk a little bit more about specifics, but I think the role of the university, which is the position that I'll speak from here, needs to take up in a more serious way the question of what equipment for living a human life do we want undergraduates to emerge with when they leave our doors? And what will those undergraduates contribute to society? And what careers will they have? and what a lot more over lives will they have that will have been enriched by that experience and that exposure during the time that we have them in our midst. Thank you.
Great. First, I want to thank George for organizing the panel, and also Patricia and Humanities West for sponsoring the panel. And what a great turnout tonight. Thank you for coming out. So the future of the humanities, I'm going to come clean. I don't know. but I have some things that give me hope and some things that concern me. I'd like to start by showing a video. And I guess I can just click on here. I had someone here that might help. So this video was created by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and it was part of a report that Congress summoned on the humanities. What is the state of the humanities? And they issued this report. And to support the report, they created this short video, and I'm going to show to you, hopefully. We'll come back to the video. I'll tell you. Yeah. Why don't we come back to that in a minute? Thank you. So the video is from this report that was created by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And Tony and I participated in these a seminar. They had seminars across the nation. One was held at Stanford. We participated along with Condoleezza Rice and George Shultz and a number of other smart people, and the findings from the report were good findings. I think everybody would be happy with these findings. Three main ones: educate Americans in the knowledge, skills, and understandings they'll need to thrive in a 21st century democracy. So that means fostering a culture of reading, writing, history, and civics. Number two, foster a society that's innovative, competitive, and strong. The idea that the humanities contribute to a fundamental sense of curiosity that's essential to a success of a culture. And then three, equip a nation for leadership in an interconnected world. So one of the speakers at our seminar that Tony and I attended was someone who had fought in Afghanistan and talked about the profound cultural misunderstandings that took place between the troops and the people who lived there, and how the humanities could really contribute to basically bringing about peace. So that was very powerful. To me, really the most powerful thing about the report was the conversation that happened afterwards. It surprised the heck out of me, because what happened was this report was issued, this wonderful video went out, and just about every media outlet picked up on this report and talked about the crisis of the humanities and talked about the importance of the humanities to our culture. And it amazed me that people were really interested in talking about this, and it gave me hope that people really cared about the humanities, as tonight does with your being here. So that gave me hope. The thing that really concerns me right now, and I hope that some of our some of my fellow panelists from academia can talk about this, is the enrollment numbers in the humanities. What about the funding of the disciplines of the humanities and so forth? From my corner of the world, where I work with the National Endowment for the Humanities very closely, the House is considering a 49% cut to the National Endowment for the Humanities, right? And so what does that say about our culture as a nation and in terms of what we value as a nation? It doesn't say much. And what's interesting to me, too, is that when you look at the cuts that are taking place across the different agencies in D.C., you'll see something like the Environmental Protection Agency being cut by 29%, which is horrible. But at the same time, why is it that they're being cut by 29% and the National Endowment for the Humanities and National Endowment for the Arts are being cut by 49%? What does that tell us about our nation? So that gives me some concern. At the same time, you know, here we are in California. What's Wallace Stegner say about California? California's America, only more so, right? And he says, he goes on to write, that other places by comparison seem less promising, less exciting, for this is indeed where the future will be made, is already being made, right? So we in the humanities, what are we doing to make that new future? What is our responsibility in California to hold up the humanities as something valuable? It's an interesting place to do that, and all our diversity and all our trend setting with everything from food to Silicon Valley to Hollywood to video games. You know, what is our responsibility in the humanities in this context? To close, I hope the video is ready to go. All right.
We can switch to someone else for a while if you want.
Terrific. I'm just going to close with what we're doing at Cal Humanities to give you a sense of some of the humanities programming that's taking place outside of academia, where I think the humanities are more valued than ever. So last year we did a program called Searching for Democracy, and we had 1,000 programs taking place across California. I went to programs in Imperial County, standing room only, to talk about the meaning of democracy, to talk about our Constitution, how it's relevant today, to talk about books like Farewell to Manzanar, about the internment of Japanese Americans and what that means for our society and where we've come from that period of time to today. It gave me heart and hope to see Imperial Valley come out for that, to see Reading come out for that, to see San Francisco, across the state, 1,000 programs, really exciting. We're planning a new program that will be a statewide initiative in 2014 called War Comes Home, where we expect to have over 1,000 programs across the state that looks at what does it mean when veterans come home from war? What is it that they carry with them? And what do we carry as a society as we think about reintegrating veterans into society? I think they're profound questions. We've selected a book by a Rhodes Scholar, a Vietnam vet by the name of Carl Marlantes, who won the National Book Award for a book called Matterhorn. The book we selected is called What It's Like to Go to War, and I recommend it to you all heartedly. It's an amazing book. So those are some of the things that are taking place outside of the Academy. Let's try this video to give them a taste of what the report was about.
There was just no volume.
Sorry?
I was just telling Andre there was no volume, that was all.
We had this sound in the tryout, so. Has George Lucas.
I like this too.
John Lithgow.
It's the best part.
This is proof that there's some need for technology as well.
Hit each other. Sciences are the how, and the humanities are the why. Why are we here? Why do we believe in the things we believe in? I don't think you can have the how without the why.
Measurable is what we know, and the immeasurable is what the heart searches for. The humanities are the immeasurable.
Philosophy, religion, history, literature, music, culture. The humanities are those subject areas that allow us to really probe what it means to be human.
We all need to find who we are and how we fit into the world.
The humanities teach us who we are.
The humanities are the epitome of human expression.
The humanities are what Thomas Jefferson meant when he said the pursuit of happiness. This is not a pursuit of objects in a marketplace of things. This is the pursuit of ideas in a marketplace of our future.
Without humanities, life doesn't have life.
That's at the heart of the matter.
They're diminishing. The humanities are diminishing.
The humanities are badly underfunded.
More at the heart of the matter, if you look that up online, and it's a 7-minute video. It's really beautiful, and it provokes interesting conversation. We can see it. I'll leave it to George.
We'll play it afterwards. Yeah. Let us stay. All right. So, thank you very much, Ralph.
Thank you.
Katie?
All right. I'm going to first thank you to George for inviting me. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm going to try and speak to some of the practical issues, some of the things that we're doing now at Stanford and why we're doing them. I'm new to my position there. I just finished my PhD, and so I sort of approach my work as the Humanities and Arts Initiatives Coordinator, thinking about what I would want to do as I interact with students in the future. I, unlike everyone else, am going to read my remarks. Stanford is searching for new ways to attract students to humanities courses while undergraduates flock to classes in popular majors such as computer science and human biology. Like Berkeley, we have some of the best humanities departments in the country, but enrollments are small in history or literature gateway courses, the introductory lectures for freshmen and sophomores. And there's a very good reason for this. Students and parents are concerned about paying off debt after graduation, and they feel pressure to pursue an education that, in theory, leads to easily identifiable job prospects. So how do we turn this tide? How do we make humanities education an affordable prospect that is attractive to students who are experiencing a level of financial stress greater than any previous generation? In many ways, universities and colleges, including Stanford, have already made significant changes to adapt their programs to financial concerns. At Stanford, parents earning below $60,000 are not expected to contribute anything, $0, to their students' education. And parents earning under $100,000 will have all tuition charges covered by non-loan aid, so scholarships and grants. But research shows that most students who would be candidates for admission and eligible for this aid are not likely to apply to somewhere like Stanford. This is a communication problem about the perception of universities at the high school level, in families, and in communities where students do not typically apply to top colleges and universities. Beyond this key issue of applications and aid is the companion problem of postgraduate employment. There are a plethora of jobs for humanities majors, but beyond the world of law, business, or medical school, or further academic study, they require creative thinking and networking to find. One of the most important changes that institutions of higher education might make, then, is communicating about and increasing campus resources that help specifically humanities students link their academic interests, their passions, to non-academic pursuits. If we can intensify the opportunities for humanities students to translate their research skills, a passion for writing, and the ability to analyze global cultures of the past and present into employment that will pay for rent and their student loans, we will be doing a great service to students who might otherwise abandon their humanities interests. Across the disciplines, academic studies and professional development have never been and still are not separate pursuits. Career services, internship programs, and the presence of industry, policy, or cultural leaders as guest speakers could offer students countless resources for closely linking their coursework to their post-graduation plans. It is detrimental to the position to position the skills and knowledge prized by the humanities at one end of a spectrum and career-oriented services and majors at another. Academic and career advising offices offer guidance that has traditionally been focused on tutoring, admittance to professional and graduate schools, corporate employment, and applications for prestigious scholarships like the Rhodes or the Marshall. These are important and usually very successful support systems that have proliferated as universities offer more to more students. They do not, however, adequately address the needs of students of English literature, Japanese history, or medieval art. Humanities students deserve more institutional attention. In this summer's reports, which were just referenced on the state of the humanities, there were calls for greater efforts to connect humanities scholarship to current public issues, to make the humanities more relevant to the American people. If, at the university level, we do not value the needs of undergraduate humanities students, then there is little incentive for society to do so. Should we celebrate the humanities as a group of disciplines that can stand apart from a materialistic world? As a society, we seem to, and feel free to disagree with me here, identify a history or a literature professor as a person who is not seeking great wealth, who is content to read and write and teach students in an idyllic college town away from the riches of the city. If this vision of academic culture, specifically for the humanities, is not entirely accurate even for the early 20th century, it is not at all representative of the professoriate today. Becoming a professor requires extensive professional preparation and networking, in addition to excellence in teaching and research. A severe distinction between career building as a negative thing and critical thinking as a positive thing cannot really hold ground when we're confronted with the difficulties of securing academic or other employment. For those students who have been encouraged to pursue graduate studies in the humanities, who have been the stars of their undergraduate programs, entry into a PhD program, and eventually the academic job market, is not and has not been for decades the easy pathway into a contemplative writing life. We owe it to these talented students to guide them towards a wider range of opportunities. And the PhD, while a type of professional preparation that we should not rule out, is not the only way for students to continue a life infused with the humanities. We cannot expect students to entirely abandon the material world, and it is the responsibility of higher education institutions to prepare students to take their academic passion beyond academia. In the absence of campus resources and staff that help humanities students bridge the gap between courses and post-college life, it takes an exceptionally self-motivated student to build a strong link between the study of, say, French literature and a job at Twitter, which we just saw in the news this week is a real thing. We should help students walk this pathway from humanities study to creatively conceptualized employment. We should encourage students to enroll in humanities courses not just because they help one develop critical thinking skills and the ability to make logical arguments, but also because they help expand the mind to envision the many elements contributing to a well-lived life. In a new curricular program called Education as Self-Fashioning at Stanford, I think it started last year, guest lectures and writing-intensive courses explore Montaigne's suggestion to future students. Let the student be asked for an account, not merely of the words of his lesson, but of its sense and substance, and judge the profit he has made by the testimony not of his memory, but of his life. This investigation of an education for life is meant to help students try on different identities, be conscious of their academic choices, and to reflect on the meaning of a college education. Beyond this course, which is aimed at freshmen and I think some sophomores, how are we helping students at Stanford to bridge the gap between academic study and humanities pursuits after Stanford? First, we're working hard to communicate to high school students about Stanford's strengths in the humanities. This summer, 100 high school students from around the world participated in the Summer Humanities Institute taught by Stanford faculty. This early intensive experience with faculty, grad students, and their peers gave the students a sampling of what undergraduate humanities study involves. It wasn't a required lecture course their freshman year. It was something that they chose to do. They liked it, and now they want to come back for more. Once undergraduates are on campus, they can enroll in immersive experiences such as the Arts Intensive, a 3-week course that combines art making with the exploration of art as an occupation. Students are also increasingly participating in service learning courses led by humanities faculty. These classes combine project work in local communities with in-depth study of a topic like human trafficking and allow students to link writing and research to real political issues. New this year, humanities majors will be eligible for special funding to participate in a foundational business course at the Graduate School of Business. For students who feel pressure to set aside their interest in a humanities field during college, this program provides an introduction to a range of critical job skills that they can pair with their humanities major and not replace their humanities major with. An art history student could, for example, gain the necessary management background for entering an arts administration position. Finally, at Stanford's Career Development Center, we hope that major changes will make a significant difference in the perception of the value of a humanities-oriented education. Our new director has redesigned the center's methods for interacting with students, adopting a community-based approach to counseling. Humanities and social science undergraduates now have a dedicated counselor who will collaborate with faculty and department staff and meet with students in their departments, not far, far away at the Career Center, which undergrads and grad students can never find. So rather than offering limited advice to smaller student populations who are able to self-identify with a particular industry, these counselors will be better placed to address the needs of majors who are ready to explore many different kinds of career options. Because disciplines like history and English open up a vast horizon of futures, students need counselors who can understand this perspective and encourage students to think inventively about their long-term goals and not push them into industry slots. These new institutional resources have been shaped with humanities students in mind. They represent part of our efforts to connect humanities students, faculty, and staff, and to show these groups how to communicate more effectively about students' educational goals. The humanities should be seen as useful in the professional world, in public policy, and also in personal development. And schools should celebrate those students who take the humanities seriously in their life pursuits. The rigor of the humanities will only be valued widely if students and faculty can make research, analysis, and communication visible in society. There should be no obstacle between the body at work and the mind attuned to critical thinking. Thanks.
I'm going to insert in here that if you want a glimpse of what the Stanford professors are doing, we have Joshua Landy coming in January to speak in this series. He's going to give the same kind of approach to the ideas. And in April, we have Lanier Anderson, another one of the professors that work in that area for the freshmen and sophomore. Mm-hmm. So now, to sum up, we have Tyler, who's dean of the undergraduate division. What you know, how to deal with the undergraduates? He's responsible for the same thing.
Well, I don't know if I can sum up, but let me start with a rather bitter joke that a lot of you have no doubt heard. It goes like this: the engineering graduate poses the question, "How does this work?" The science graduate poses the question, "Why does this work?" The humanities graduate poses the question, "Would you like fries with that?" So, this is a bitter joke, but it's worth taking it into consideration because I think it does sum up very neatly the whole idea of the crisis of the humanities and the way a lot of students in particular and their parents look at it. There are a number of things I can say tonight, but one of the things I wanted to talk about is my own experience with Berkeley's largest advising office and how we advise students as to their career paths. And if there's one prototypical student that we have to deal with, a student in trouble, it's the student who has knocked his or her head against trying to make it succeed in a science major or a technology or engineering or mathematics major and is not succeeding and has to look at alternatives. Sometimes these are students that are, say, in their sophomore year and are already in academic trouble. Sometimes these are students after 2 years have basically flunked out of the university and appealing for readmission. And we are telling, in the position of telling them that, you know, you might have wanted to be a biochemistry major, but your grades say otherwise, and it's not going to work for you, and you're going to have to look at something else. These can be heartbreaking conversations, especially because oftentimes these students are not pressuring themselves, they're dealing with parental pressure. To give one example, we had one student who had been basically dismissed for poor performance in his science classes, who described himself as born to be a doctor. And when he told his parents that he wanted to reapply to Berkeley and go into the humanities, they not only threatened to cut him off financially, but also threatened to continue to list him as a dependent so he could not apply for financial aid at the university. And I'm not saying these are bad parents.
Don't you mind?
You may think otherwise. But they had a specific idea of what would succeed for their son and what would not succeed. So when you talk about the crisis of the humanities, you have to look at it at that level. Okay, why is it that students and students' families who are investing so heavily in their education, which they see oftentimes as their one real key to success in life, feel that this is not going to fit the bill? Now, I'm sure many of you have read or heard or discussed the whole various nature of the crisis of the humanities. For example, there's all sorts of statistics out there. So there's all sorts of numbers. People talk about the decline in enrollments in humanistic departments. And there are other people that say, such as Berkeley's English professor Scott Saul, who claimed in a recent New York Times op-ed piece that this was not really true, if you looked specifically at it school by school. There's also the issue, what would you like with would you like fries with that issue? Can students in the humanities get jobs? One of the things I like to do, one of my vices, is I like to read newspapers online because then you can read all the online commentary, which as a social historian I find fascinating, albeit oftentimes very, very depressing. And I remember once reading a comment on one of these issues where one woman wrote in and said, there has never in the history of the world been anybody who majored in history who got a job without connections. And I remember thinking, well, I didn't have a lot of connections. I know lots of people that don't. But what's important is less how accurate such a statement is like that, and more that it is actually being articulated and a lot of people seem to believe it. So there are these kinds of questions. There are pressures from university administrations in an era of declining funding for universities to maximize revenue-generating sectors of the university. And there, finally, there's the whole political discussion about the value of the humanities. Ralph's, you cut off David Brooks there, which, well, I don't know if that's a good thing or not. But this is one of the main sort of exponents of this whole idea that the humanities basically shot themselves in the foot by embracing political correctness, multiculturalism, so on and so forth, the whole culture wars of the 1990s. So there are all those arguments. And again, people have argued them back and forth. And it's actually one of the signs of the vibrancy, the continued vibrancy of the humanities, that are still very much a subject for dispute. But I think I also want to put this in a broader context in terms of how the world is changing and why those changes lead to a situation where so many students and so many students' parents feel that the humanities are a dead end. We live in a world of increased inequality, of increased pressure, of increased uncertainty. And I was thinking over how to best encapsulate this, and I came up with one number, and you can fit this one number to two different situations. The number is 3,000. $3,000 is the cost of the average three-bedroom house in the city of Detroit currently. $3,000 is also the cost of a 1 square foot of housing in Belgravia, London today. So you have, in terms of the inequality of the world, so in other words, if you wanted to get a three-bedroom house in Belgravia, you'd probably be spending upwards of $5 million, conservatively speaking, as opposed to $3,000 in Detroit. Now, this example says two things. First of all, just the fact that we can speak about Detroit and London in the same sentence shows the extent to which our world has become globalized and has become interactive on a planetary scale in ways that was not true even a generation ago. But it also speaks to the tremendous pressure on families who are sending their children to school. Do you want to live in Detroit or do you want to live in Belgravia? And is there any other alternative to the two? Because increasingly it seems we're living in a world where those are the two alternatives. And parents who are investing in their children's education are deathly afraid if their children will not have the ability to live in Belgravia, they're going to be in Detroit. Okay. So I think that's why there is this fear that if you do not take advantage of those areas of opportunity that are gold-plated, then you're risking your future permanently. Ultimately, what this says is that people are looking for the kind of magic bullet career, and yet one of the main themes of the humanities is that there is no magic bullet. There is no certainty. There is no gold-plated solution. It is our, perhaps, fate to be the Cassandras of the modern world, making this statement, which nobody wants to hear, and yet is absolutely true. And I think what we in the humanities argue instead is that if there's anything that is going to ensure success, if anything, and probably nothing will, but if there is any chance of doing so, it is certain skills, it is certain mindset, it's certain abilities to think critically, to express oneself effectively. Those are the kinds of things that we teach. And above all, it is the ability to understand that there is no permanency, there is no stability in the world, that the only constant is change, in other words. And those people that are best, are most likely to succeed in the world are those people that are precisely able to change with the changing nature of the world. I like to tell people that, for example, I went to college with, I went to college with Bill Gates, but I got my degree, so. Bill Gates did not become a multi-billionaire by taking a major in computer science, because basically that did not exist at that point, or was just starting to exist. He became the success he is today not by following somebody else's path, but by creating his own. And I think ultimately what the humanities have to offer is this idea that you have to create your own path in the world if you're going to be a success, and even if you're going to have a basic sense of stability. Okay, thank you.
That was a great summation, because that's the main point. And I think that what I find fascinating is it's a little bit like generals fighting the last war. The parents who are successful that made their success on the backs of their own education now want that for their children, but that might not be the same thing. And certainly the schools that they went to are no longer the same as they were. That river is no longer the same river it was at that time. There's now 20 times the number of applications for most of those schools. So it's time for Q&A, and as I said before, we'll show that video as soon as the hour is over and the Q&A is done. So let's start. And you can make the question general or directed to any one of the four.
When I was an undergraduate at Harvard, the antediluvian, before the flood of technology, which has drowned us all, we were required to take a literature course, and I still remember it, the Aeneid, the Odyssey and the Iliad, or something like that, social science, you know, history of revolution, philosophy of the English Enlightenment, and science. I was a chemistry major, but even I was grateful for that. But I remember I fulfilled that requirement by watching Burroughs Skinner's Pigeons Dance Around. The question I have for you was, what is the requirement for, quote, general education at Stanford University of California? And if not, why shouldn't there be?
Stanford has just introduced an entire new set of requirements called the Ways of Thinking and Ways of Doing, in addition to a two-year intensive writing requirement. So these Ways of Thinking and Ways of Doing are very similar to general distribution requirements. I was an undergrad at Johns Hopkins, and there were sort of like quantitative reasoning and qualitative reasoning and ethical, logical reasoning. So there are those broad categories, and courses will fit into those buckets. And so that's how the requirements are working now. That sort of bucket system is replacing the old introduction to the humanities, one-year sort of lecture and intensive writing and discussion section course that used to exist, which in its turn had replaced the Western Civ requirement, I think, in the early 90s. So this is the first year where the freshman class is coming in and will experience 4 years of the new curriculum, new requirements. I won't say that much more because I'm certainly no expert on it, and I know that the undergrad advising office is really working very, very hard with faculty to help communicate to students what these are and why they're valuable, and you have more freedom to make choices about what courses will fulfill these goals, because I think there's a sense that they don't want to sort of overburden students with requirements, that students will be happier about their education if they have are able to make more choices that do fulfill general obligations. I'll stop there.
You want Cal's answer?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So the situation is somewhat similar. There are two requirements that are university-wide, and those are requirements in writing and in foreign language. Both, in my humble opinion, are woefully inadequate, and one of my hopes is to find ways for us, at least in the Division of Arts and Humanities, if not across the College of Letters and Science or all of Berkeley, to increase those. But beyond those, in letters and science, a series of breadth requirements, much as what was just described for Stanford, where there are a number of areas, including philosophy and values, international and area studies or something of the sort, social sciences and so on, that are fulfilled by a number of courses. But I think to speak to the question, neither of these situations is one in which there is a prescribed curriculum where all students will read a series of books together in common or experience a similar number of artworks or examples of music or so forth, which we'd really call a core curriculum. One of the only places that has a core curriculum currently of the major institutions is Columbia. And I'll just relate to you an anecdote that's reported to be that of Jacques Barzin, who taught for many years at Columbia, who was responding to the challenge that, you know, 10, 15, 20 years later, we've forgotten those books. And his response was, yes, but we will have forgotten the same ones.
I'm in a corner, so this question can go to anywhere. Besides, very broad. My question is this, and it's a broad question. I do research among refugee people and immigrants. And the question really go into language. The language that Bakhtin and Wittgenstein declare and analyze for so long. This has to do, and also following Manuel Castell, and all of you know about him, professor in UC Berkeley, how the human being can contact, and this is part of my research, how we can deal with understanding of connection in the new technology, you know, and digital technology of today. And I that in humanity, that's a big question, because connection through language is diminished, has diminished so much. And in humanity, we understand to talk, to understand language, historical, artistic, and so on. And all of you has this, proved that. So the question is very, very large. And it has to do with my research that constantly the people that are immigrant or refugee say to touch, you know, the computer, especially the older generation, I don't get them, I cannot contact my people because it's not, they're not there anymore. We are so isolated, far away from where is homeland, and homeland through digital and technology doesn't fit and doesn't work. That's my question, but also it's a kind of answer because I have the data and the material of my research and also my publication, sorry.
So how has the digitization of communication, anybody who has a teenager knows all about this, how has the digitization of computer, of language and communication affected the humanities in that we don't talk directly to people. We talk indirectly to them through our computers and through our emails and through our much more modern things than email.
Well, let me just speak to that briefly, because I think it goes two ways. I mean, I love to see my son getting together with their friends, and each of them is on their smartphone or their iPad or so on and so forth, and in some ways they're not communicating, according to me, they're not communicating with each other at all. On the other hand, technology has enabled a tremendous range of voices that even a generation ago were not available to most people. I mean, you can get on your laptop and read newspapers from throughout the world in a way that you could not have done 20 years ago. And you can read the individual comments from the people writing about those newspapers. One of the things that's happening in my field in history is that when I was a graduate student, it was the tradition that students would go to their archive, wherever it was, spend a long time, maybe years, investigating the documents, copying down laboriously, and things were not indexed online or anything like that. You can speak to that, Katie. Whereas now I have students that will go with a digital camera, and in a couple of weeks,
take
40,000 images, right? Now, of course, you still have to sit down and read those images at some point.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But it has revolutionized in many ways the collection of knowledge. People are creating their own archives, in effect. So I think it cuts different ways. On the one hand, I think, and you know, the questioner's point was very much, you know, very well taken, because it does mean that people that are not part of this can feel really excluded. My mother, for example, doesn't want to deal with going online at all. And I try to explain to her that you're really excluded from a lot of what's going on in the world, let alone what's going on with your grandson. But she's just not going to do it, right? And that has impacts. You know, the digital divide is generational as well as socioeconomic. On the other hand, it does mean that there are tremendous resources out there.
Yeah, I just would add to everything that Tyler said, that the question of technology is a very old one. Plato's critique of writing was already a critique of technology. And the university needs to be a space, and I think it is a space, in which that's capacious enough both to explore new developments in technology and also to provide for critical reflection about technology. So the fact that and technology is a many-faced and many-faceted thing. On the one hand, it can bring people together who exist in very separate locations or in distant places, and at the same time, it can be alienating. And I think a university is a place that can both be inventive and innovative, but also ask value questions about the role of technology and what it's doing with us and for us or against us.
And at Cal Humanities, I know we work with a number of immigrant groups across California, from Eritrean communities to Iraqi communities, Iranian communities, and the younger generation is using technology to actually gather stories of their elders about what it means to come to this country and talk about their journey and culture from the old country and preserving those online so that for future generations they can tap into that knowledge. So that's a positive way that technology is being used, where the elders in the community might feel uncomfortable with the technology. I think it's a beautiful thing that those stories and that culture is being preserved by the younger generations for future generations.
We've run out of time, unfortunately, for questions. If you have questions, you can come up afterwards. But I would like to say, for those who worry about the conflict between the material world and the humanities, that this is the divide that technology presents. It's been going on forever. All I have to do is go back to dating. You know, people like to present themselves as an image to other people, and they don't present an accurate image. They present something that's there for the other person to buy, right? And all this technology, and it's not a surprise that it's been used for dating, is to create an image that you present to the world, and that's what you're presenting, and that's what you go by. And but there are always people who do heart-to-heart connections with other people all the time, and the humanities are an attempt to say, this is actually an enjoyable part of life. You might be really afraid of it, and you will have uncomfortable experiences with it, but this is really the profound thing that makes life worth living. And so the technology is there. It enables us to keep our distance even better than before. But as you said, you get more and more people to talk to each other in different ways, and the access to knowledge that our kids are doing to write their papers and everything is unbelievable. So there's all kinds of advantages, but the basic human approach to how do we deal with other people, are they objects or are they other individuals? That's what we're trying to tell people. It's actually they're other individuals. That's what the humanities are for. Well, thank you very much. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club, and it's 111th year of enlightened discussion.
Speak from my notes. I'm going to get.